This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Retired Normal City Manager Mark Peterson is sounding a warning about the willingness of state and federal elected officials to compromise and solve serious issues. He's concerned big decisions will eventually be driven by a crisis.
You don't have the ability to sit back and think about things and work together to try to come up with something. They're going to happen quickly, and they're going to happen forcefully, and they're going to be brutal.
Find out how state and federal gridlock is affecting local government's ability to deliver services. Hear from an Illinois State University student graduating this weekend. John Norton talks with a student who also happens to be ISU's first black homecoming queen. And during an edition of Animal House, find out how so-called zombie raccoons can present a deadly threat to your pets. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's May 10th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Normal's former city manager has retired but is still speaking out, and he has a warning. Mark Peterson wrote an article for a professional journal that was rejected as too strongly worded. He rewrote it, but eventually just pulled it. Over 30 years with the town, Peterson says he's seen a decline in compromise by elected officials at the state and federal level and weaker partnerships with state and federal governments. He says that's affecting local governments and residents. He says there's less ability for local government to meet citizen expectations for service.
And that's due to, I think, some fundamental changes in the funding model, the traditional funding model used by government. That model just doesn't work like it did 15 or 20 years ago. And government is always slow to react and slow to change. And therefore, you read it everywhere. I don't know of any local government anywhere in the country that isn't having budget problems, and some more than others. But part of that is the model in which most of us subscribe to. Most, when I say us, I'm talking about local governments, to provide basic services to the
sales taxes.
Well, that's part of it, but it's other taxes as well that have been eroded in some cases by actions of the state or federal government, in some cases by just changes in behavior and changes in technology. For example, many cities collect a significant amount of money from telephone usage. That applies to landlines. It doesn't apply to cell phones. And obviously, landlines are declining, you know, exponentially every year, and that has affected the revenue source. And in Illinois, the state legislature made some fundamental changes to how local governments tax electricity, which we always have had a franchise tax and electricity tax, and now consequently that revenue source brings in far less revenue than it used to. And then the big one is sales tax. That's the big one.
You wrote in an unpublished article that the two-party system is failing, and that's likely to have a catastrophic consequence on the lives of residents who choose to live in a city or a town. We'll get to that, but first let's talk about the article. Why write it? How did that come about? And why is it unpublished?
Yeah, I was asked for one of the professional associations, of which I am still a member and have been for years, they asked me to put together some thoughts on the state of government and the fact that I've been a player in government for 35 years and have had kind of a unique opportunity to watch it and study it and see what changes are occurring. And we're at a point right now in government, and I'm talking primarily at the state and federal level, although to some degree at the local level, where we're seeing some fundamental changes in how government operates. And they are kind of, in my mind, uncharted waters and disturbing. And so they asked me to put some thoughts together, which I did. They've not published the piece yet, and I'm not sure if they will. I think in part because it was pretty direct and I think there's some concern that some constituents of that organization might find it to be offensive a little bit. It wasn't intended to be. It was more intended to just be my observations about what's happening in this country.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about some of the things that are on your mind. They did, of course, ask you to break a few dishes on your way out the door.
Yes.
But they decided there were just, maybe you broke the stove and the refrigerator too. I don't know.
I guess. Because they did say don't hold back. Yeah. But when I didn't, I think they got a little uncomfortable. But so, that's okay.
So can you cite some examples of this failure of the two-party system on the national and state level? Are you talking about gridlock, the ability to get anything done? Maybe we can talk about pensions at the state level, all those things?
Yeah. You've hit – it's gridlock. It's the inability to address complex problems that are desperate for a solution. A pension's a great one here in our own state of Illinois. There is no debate that the lack of funding or lack of funding of our public pension systems is a huge problem, and it's growing every day, and we need to solve it. We need to fix the problem, yet there is complete paralysis in our state legislature. They're not even talking about it right now. It's not even discussed because there are other probably maybe less critical problems that they can't even come to grips with, let alone trying to solve the problems associated with public pensions. So that's an example. And I say two-party, but it really goes beyond party. It's almost ideology. And it's what I see, this extremism that is occurring, particularly at the state and federal level when you talk about the legislatures. But also I think we're beginning to see a little bit of it sometimes at the local level as well. But this extremism where somebody has bought into a certain ideological perspective and they are completely unwilling to compromise. And that's the foundation of the legislative process, is compromise. That without compromise, it cannot work. And there are members of Congress, members probably of the Illinois General Assembly, who said, I will not compromise, and frankly are proud of it. And they, when they run for reelection, they talk about how I didn't sell out, I didn't compromise. They would rather shut government down than compromise. And that's disastrous, potentially, because when you look at things like immigration reform and, we just went through this tax reform issue, which was basically, a single party driven initiative, healthcare reform.
Infrastructure, which we'll get to in a moment.
Huge.
So it's not rocket science, is it? The solution in Springfield, details aside, it's pretty simple to solve the budget problem, isn't it? I mean, on the surface, right? It's going to take. You tell me, what would it
take?
Well,
I wouldn't say it's simple.
I mean, it's painful.
It's painful, and it's complex, and it's going to require, people working hard to come up with solutions. But it is solvable.
But it's
solvable.
It's revenue, it's cuts.
Yes.
It's both.
It's both.
Over a long period of time.
Yes, it's both over a long period of time.
And that's what I meant by simple.
Because we have ignored the problem for so long, that is why it is going to be painful. But it is straightforward. These are, as you said, it's not nuclear physics or rocket science. It's inflow and outflow. And so you've got to, in the case of the state of Illinois, we've got to reduce expenses. In some cases, I've said that means good programs are going to have to go, even though they're good, valuable programs and so forth. And then we've got to figure out a way to raise revenue. And then we have to have the discipline to stay the course for maybe a decade or so. And then maybe, just maybe, we'll be back to a situation where we're financially healthy.
So how are the failures in Springfield and in Washington, D.C., maybe the failure to compromise, making our lives and the jobs of local government officials, as you write, dramatically more difficult?
Well, first of all, we're beginning to see in Springfield that the General Assembly is forcing the hard decisions down to the local level. School districts, you take responsibility for the pensions. Mm. Oh, wow, great. And by withholding, we're going to keep revenue that we've given to you and we've promised to you, but we've changed our mind. We're going to keep it because we need it. That forces local governments to make those hard decisions. Are we going to cut expenses? Are we going to raise revenue? And frankly, most local governments have been pretty responsible. They balance their budgets. They don't have the ability to go in with an unbalanced budget. They can't print money. So they have to balance their budgets every year. But what we're seeing out of the state government is, hey, we have not been able to effectively do our job, so we're gonna force the tough decisions on you. And what's really annoying, I guess, and bizarre is they're actually now talking about limiting the ability of local governments to raise money, particularly school districts, through property tax limitations. And it's like, wow.
So then what?
Yeah, then what? That now we've taken, you know, a big part of our arsenal away, and so then it forces local governments to do things on the expense side because there's limits on the revenue side, particularly school districts that have very limited ability to raise revenue beyond property taxes.
In fact, wasn't there an instance just that affected the last town of Normal budget that the state decided it was going to keep part of the redistribution of tax funds and with very little notice?
So it just left
a million-dollar hole in the town of Normal budget, didn't it?
It was a little less than that, but it was something that was in the compromise budget that we didn't find out about until the budget was passed, and I don't think many people even knew it was in there. And those things can happen, but fundamentally, and again, I think with the state of Illinois, everybody's going to have to be part of the solution, and local governments are going to feel pain, as are school districts and counties and municipalities, and clearly the state is going to have to make some hard decisions. And we can say, you know, cite similar examples at the federal level as well. But I'm seeing that it's harder and harder for legislatures to come together to enact what I would consider to be reasonable and effective solutions to complex problems because they are not willing to compromise. And that's both D's and R's, right and left. Depending, it's both sides. I'm not casting stones at any particular party. We're all guilty of it. And ultimately, Mike, it's the voters. It's those of us who put people and vote. We need to demand it. And we need to. And if that's not being done, then we need to put more people in there that will do that. Now, let me say this. I believe that there is a large number of I believe that most of our legislators are good people and they're well-intentioned. And I believe that most of them or many of them want to compromise. And they just feel that in this environment where there's so much money being spent by people who represent extreme viewpoints, that they're fearful that they'll be voted out of office by even if they're let's use an example as a Republican who is interested in compromising, his own party, people within his own party will not tolerate that, or her own party, and they will mount some sort of a campaign. They don't care if they're Republican; they're not voting the way I vote. You could say the same thing about Democrats, and that's frightening. So I think there are a number of very good legislators who truly want to work collaboratively across the aisle, and they just don't feel like they can.
That's former Town of Normal City Manager Mark Peterson. He retired after a career in municipal government, 30 years of that with the town. As the federal government fails to deal with important issues such as immigration or health care or infrastructure, how are local governments reacting? And let's take infrastructure. So important, so expensive.
Yeah.
How many years has the federal government been kicking the can down the road regarding the gas tax, which funds infrastructure like roads and bridges along with transit? And has that had an effect on local government?
No question. Local and state governments. The federal government has for for decades been a major partner with local governments in infrastructure funding. And part of it is the gas tax, but there's a number of other sources that they've used to help undertake significant local and regional infrastructure projects. We're talking about roads and bridges, even in some cases buildings and underground utilities, things like that. Well, slowly but surely, the amount of funding available from federal sources for those kinds of things has dwindled, and now we're hearing, I mean, things coming out of Washington that are just almost unbelievable, where I think the Trump administration has been talking about reversing the match. Traditionally, when a project becomes federally eligible, the federal government picks up the largest share of that cost.
So as much as an 80-20 split.
80-20 is typical. Sometimes it's 70-30. Sometimes it's 60-40. But 80-20 is traditional. Now the administration and the U.S. Department of Transportation is talking about maybe we need to reverse that, and the federal government will pick up 20% and let the locals pick up 80%. That seems like a more equitable share. Well, that's fine, but it means these projects won't happen because there's no way local governments can foot 80% of the cost, so they won't happen.
I don't want to sound like a New Deal Democrat here, but are we missing out in terms of an economic boost with addressing our infrastructure needs?
Well, absolutely. Infrastructure. And the interesting thing about infrastructure—
We'd be putting people back to work.
Absolutely. The interesting thing about infrastructure is it is probably one of the few— issue or one of the few spending categories that has bipartisan support. Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, they all like infrastructure because, for one thing, it does put people back to work. It drives our economic engine. It's good for economic development. Infrastructure is a good thing, and nobody debates infrastructure. And despite the fact that infrastructure funding is universally popular— And I'm even talking – people that are generally anti-government and anti-tax –
President
are okay.
Trump has even signaled that he's in favor of looking at the gas tax, an increase.
Exactly. They're okay with – as long as it's going to roads and, you know,
bridges.
Curbs and gutters and bridges, we're okay with that. Despite that, the federal government has been unable to come up with a sustainable funding source and a plan for infrastructure across the country, and that's boggling to me.
So local governments in Illinois, in the absence of robust IDOT funding and federal transportation funding, are left to do more on their own, but they can't because their projects are too expensive.
Right.
We're not
talking
about repaving. We're talking about replacing bridges and things like that.
Correct. Correct. We've probably done more in Normal than most communities, but you're right. They budgets are already stretched. They can't do it. So and the fact is, I mentioned this to somebody the other day. Most of you are probably too young to remember the old Fram oil filter commercial. You can pay me now or you can pay me later.
Sure.
Well, some of these infrastructure improvements can be undertaken when they're early enough at a reasonable cost. But if you wait 10, 12, 15 years, the cost is 3, 4, 5 times that because the whether it's a bridge or a road, has so badly deteriorated that it needs to be completely removed and replaced. So by biting the bullet and getting some of these repairs done maybe sooner than later, you're going to save a lot of money.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Retired Town of Normal City Manager Mark Peterson is in the studio, and we're talking about how state and federal governments and politics are having a negative impact on local municipalities. Compromise seems to be alive and well in Bloomington Normal among the two councils. Why do you think local elected officials can seem to work together more effectively than those on the state or national level?
Well, that's a great question, and I guess I would suggest that because the buck stops right here locally, and they have to, they're the ones who are ultimately directly accountable, and they have to figure out a way to get it done. They have to solve problems. So they don't have a choice. Now, I hear from colleagues throughout the country that they're seeing this, I will call this extremism that's happening in the state and federal, beginning slowly infiltrate local governments. And I hear of situations where you do have gridlock at the local level as well, because people of diverse ideological perspectives, and these may be nonpartisan situations. There's no party involved, but they just have an inability to work together to compromise and collaborate. But fortunately, in central Illinois, particularly Bloomington Normal, that has not been the case, and I think there's reason to be optimistic that that's going to continue here. Well, I think both our city councils, they have their differences, of course, but they generally, at the end of the day, try to work together to solve serious problems.
Play that out for me a little bit, if you would. How much can staff get done with a council that is mired in politics and obstructionism and
and maybe petty personality disagreements. Can staff maneuver around like the state and federal government? The state and federal governments, no matter how bad politics gets, the bureaucracy seems to still get most of the job done.
They do.
Well, what about on the local level?
Well, it makes it harder. Those of us that are I keep seeing I'm no longer part of that group, but those that are staff members spend a lot more time working on strategy and maneuvering things through these this minefield, this political minefield. That takes a tremendous amount of time and energy that you can't spend on other things that are more productive. So yes, staff I think can help, and they can still get some things done. And I think you make a good point that at the state and federal level, there are some really good dedicated people at the staff level that are in these agencies that are running programs that are, despite some of the frustrations I'm sure they feel regarding the legislative branch, they're still committed to getting things done. And I will tell you this, I have had the opportunity to interact with we'll call them bureaucrats. That's
which has a negative. I use the word bureaucracy. It has a negative connotation. It doesn't necessarily have to.
It does, and it's unfortunate because I've worked with people at the federal level in these agencies, and I'm telling you, these are extremely dedicated, committed, hardworking, very bright people who want to do good things. They are the antithesis of the stereotype of a bureaucrat. They are hardworking, they are committed, and they continue to work very hard to help, whether it's local governments or the people that they serve. And I think staff can play a role, but it makes it so much more difficult, and you burn a lot of staff time just navigating these sort of these troubled political waters that could be more productively used on other things.
We've not talked much about the president. By most accounts, he's not leading well. There's a lot of reaction there, not a lot of leading. Do you think a backlash to the occupant in the White House could help sweep out what you call extremist legislators? Could change be on the horizon?
Well, there's two ways. That's possible, but I also see a lot of good people that are getting out. I see on both sides of the aisle people that who I think are fundamentally good legislators.
U.S. Senator Jeff Flake on the Republican side.
Great.
Said, I'm
yes.
out.
Yeah, he's one example
Bob
of many.
Bob Corker, another senator. Both
Flake and Corker are very conservative, but good legislators. I mean, good people. They understand what needs to be done, and they're like, I'm done. I'm out. And I think the president probably has hastened their departure. And I think there's things probably happening. I know there's on the other side as well. I'm done. I can't do this anymore. My guess is if you put this question to Senator Durbin, who has been in the U.S. Senate Congress for many, many years, I think he will tell you the same thing. It grinds you down. It's frustrating when you're there to do good work and you can't sit down with colleagues across the aisle and have meaningful conversations that could result in solutions. And it's not just the president, but you know, certainly right now it's a fascinating period in our history with what's going on in the White House.
In your article that is still unpublished, you write that you fear some sort of crisis could precipitate change.
Yes.
What sort of crisis? And I guess we should explore what kind of decisions actually take place during a crisis. Not very good ones.
Well, let's talk about the state of Illinois. I mean, at some point, there will be a funding crisis. This pension issue is enormous. It is huge. And we're not even talking about it right now in Springfield. We're ignoring it. We're focusing on other things that are not unimportant. But I mean, this pension thing is going to break our financial future. And at some point, something's got to happen whether it's external forces come to bear, whether it's bond markets, whether it's I don't know what, that come in and force change. And you're right, at that point, options are very limited. And you don't have the ability to sit back and think about things and work together to try to come up with something. They're going to happen quickly, and they're going to happen forcefully, and they're going to be brutal.
Mark Peterson, congratulations on your retirement from the town of Normal. and thanks for your public service.
Thank you, Mike.
Peterson says there is a ray of hope. He says Illinois does have some creative and committed lawmakers at both the state and federal levels. Peterson, who retired as the Town of Normal city manager at the end of March, says one positive of state and federal government dysfunction is local government will be more hesitant to take on projects that could be considered sprawl. He says roads and distant subdivisions cost communities. He also said future community comprehensive plans should plan for less robust state and federal partnerships. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Illinois State University, ranked by College Factual as the 22nd best college for the money out of 1,200 schools across the country. More information is available online at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, find out how so-called zombie raccoons could present a threat to your pet. It's an edition of Animal House on the way during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's graduation season. Illinois State University will present diplomas tomorrow and Saturday to several thousand young people. Ashley Shannon is one of them, student body vice president, also the first ISU African-American homecoming queen. In this conversation with GLT's John Norton, Shannon says the first time she stepped on campus was during preview, the time when students picked their classes. She knew then she wanted to be a journalist.
I chose journalism at a young age. I remember just sitting with my parents, like, being 10 years old and then copying what they're doing off TV. And then you would think during commercial you would go get a snack, but I would make my parents sit there and listen to me talk about the news and what I thought about it. So that's what I decided to pursue. And then later on, I took up social justice as my minor.
So did you work at WZND or TV10 or The Vedette while you were here?
I worked at TV10 News. I was a reporter, anchor, and producer, and I co-founded the first all-black talk show this semester called What's Happening.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I always wanted to do something for my community. I really appreciate TV10 and the basics it teaches you, but it didn't give me enough room to give my opinion and talk about systematic oppression or entertainment and everything like that. And so a couple of my friends, we originally wanted to start our own YouTube channel, and it became an idea last year, my junior year, but it never got off the ground. We all just couldn't find time for it. We would have to pay for equipment. All of these things just got in the way. And so after Mallory Lovings, if you've heard of her, she was an amazing student and also anchor at TV10. And after she came forward and had her own show, it opened the doors for a lot of other students to have their own show. So we pitched the idea to our director, Laura and Bob, and they were like, okay, sounds good. Let's try it. And ever since, it just took off and people really like cling to it, I guess. And now hopefully they'll pick it up and keep going with it.
Did you have a favorite story that you did?
During What's Happening?
Yeah.
I would have to say the note I liked leaving off on was the Kanye incident. We talked about Kanye West and how he attempted to say slavery was a choice. At the table, none of us obviously agreed that it was a choice, but it was that debate on, have we been talking about slavery too long or should the conversation continue? And it's an ongoing debate even within our own community, and it was just unique hearing other people's ideas.
So you're focusing on journalism in your communications degree. Mm-hmm. Except now you're going to the University of Illinois Law School.
Yeah, I switched it up on everyone.
Boy, no kidding. I mean, you could have a limo as a lawyer, right?
But I don't want to be a lawyer. That's the crazy part.
Oh, well, tell me about what. Why did you decide that you're going to go to U of I Law School, and what do you want to accomplish with that then?
So U of I is one of 8 to 10 programs in the country that allow you to earn a Master's of Studies in Law or any other title that other schools go by. And it basically means I want to incorporate law into what I'm already studying, but I don't want to be a lawyer. So they give you the opportunity to do so and expand your ideas. So I knew I wanted to do something pertaining to either production and journalism, which is what I studied, obviously. But I also always had an interest in inmates and the prison system. And not to talk about, you know, how sad their lives are in general, but just to dig deep into those stories and talk about systematic oppression, talk about how we don't return humanity to inmates during or after incarceration. And so I want to make documentaries pertaining to their stories. So I decided, in order to, you know, kind of tear down the man, to talk about the law and things like that, I first need to go about understanding it, to have the credibility to cover these stories.
Why did this topic grab your attention?
At a very young age, my father's an activist. He grew up under the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr. That was his pastor growing up. My father was also an activist. He worked in fair housing. And from a very young age, we would go to Alabama, and my parents made sure we were instilled in the values of civil rights. And so from there, I grew up with the understanding that anything I can do to show social justice in any type of way, obviously that's my minor as well, let me do it. Let me go about it. And so I had to find my niche and how I would do that. And for some reason, prisoners just attracted me in some way. I don't know what it was, but they don't have their rights given back to them. And to see someone go through all of these years in prison and then to come back out just to still mentally be bound to the system that they were in, it's a sad situation. And so I kind of just, I guess, is it sympathetic or empathetic? I never know which one it is.
Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, I guess you could say that I just had that feeling towards them. And it was kind of a situation like, how can I be of service to you all, rather than always making them do things for us.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I'm talking with Ashley Shannon, a graduating Illinois State University student in journalism and communication. She's heading to the U of I Law School. She's going to get her master's in study in law at the University of Illinois. Well, you've been pretty busy on the ISU campus aside from studying.
Definitely.
You have done probably more than, more than a lot of people do in a lifetime in 4 years at ISU. Let me start with, you were royalty at ISU,
yeah,
in 2016.
That's so weird to hear, royalty. Yeah. 2016, I was part of the first black couple to be crowned homecoming king and queen at the university.
It was a big deal at the time.
It was. I think for anybody to get homecoming king and queen, it's a big deal. But to have made history during that, the people from our community that graduated in like the 60s were literally coming up to us and saying, you're changing things. We thank you. We love you. Like, to hear that from strangers you've never met, it's obviously something that's a big deal to our community. Even though it's just homecoming, it wasn't just that to us.
This country is still wrestling with its race problem, right? A lot of
obviously,
people
yeah.
obviously call it its original sin.
Right.
You and I grew up very differently, different eras and in different communities, right?
Yeah.
How important is even little things like two black people being homecoming king and queen on a majority white campus?
I mean, it means hope. It means that we're better than the circumstances we've been through. A lot of the times when you talk about black people, the furthest thing you can date back when you list our accomplishments is when the hot comb was created, which is used to do black females' hair. You don't think about all of the incredible things we do on a regular basis because we've been taught to only talk about black people when they're doing something negative, when somebody gets shot, when someone gets arrested, when it involves police brutality. And so for once, every now and then, to hear a story that means we're better despite the things that surround us, despite the obstacles that surround our community. Like, that you don't have to picture Jalen Joyner, the homecoming king, as a guy that's going to get arrested or shot by the police or something like that. For once, you can picture him in a better light. We were once kings and queens in our own country before we were taken, in our own continent before we were taken. And to picture us in that position is giving us back the hope that we lost along the way here.
There are still a lot of people in our country who don't even want to talk about that.
Right.
They're just saying everything's better now. Everybody's equal now.
I don't think it's ever been better. I think that I always say this, and my father has kind of taught me this as well as through reading and literature. The system has never gotten better. It's just changed its name. Slavery has never left the premise. It's only changed into Jim Crow. Jim Crow meaning we still suffer through the system. We're just suffering mentally. We don't have chains physically on us, but they're on our minds. And so we can only move so far out of the crevice that we're sitting in, because we're not given room to move out of the system. It's harder for a black man to move up than anyone else. And we know that. And even now, I think the modern day slave is a black woman, because within our own communities, we're told to take a back seat. So I don't think things have ever really changed. I think people just don't want to acknowledge them for what they are.
I think we have enough evidence that says, yes, what you're saying is exactly true. There's mm-hmm. still a lot of people that don't believe that, though, and a lot of people that don't even want to have that conversation. Yeah. How do you have that conversation? Whose responsibility is it to have that conversation?
I think a lot of people put it on our community to start that conversation, but when we
do... Is that fair?
No, I don't think it actually is fair, because when we do start the conversation, we're ridiculed for doing so, because it's, you always want to talk about race.
Right.
You always want to start an issue. That you're that angry black woman, you know what I mean? I'm not angry. I'm just intelligent. I just want to talk about the issues our country is facing. And I don't think that people are going to wake up overnight that ignore this problem, that don't actually face it on a regular basis and want to have the conversation. That's just not possible, because it's the same thing about, like, let's talk LGBTQ community. I'm not going to wake up overnight and say, oh, I want to have a conversation about this. It takes me actually physically going to the issue to say, like, okay, I'm going to listen. And so the same thing with the black community. You can't just wake up one day and say, oh, I'm just going to get involved in it. You actually have to go and listen and be a part of the conversations before you choose to actually discuss it within a room. And so I think that it takes those people willing to at least step into the room, not necessarily talk about things that they don't know, but to just listen to the conversation. And I think it's not until people are faced with an issue and it actually affects them, it affects their families, that they're the ones making the news, that they're the ones in the headlines, that they actually will want to be a part of that.
Ashley Shannon is our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. She's a graduating journalism student at Illinois State University this weekend. You were in the system, at least the Illinois State University government system.
Yes.
You ran and you were vice president.
Right.
Why did you want to run for student government?
Dates back to junior year when Andrew Jacobs.
High school or college?
College.
Okay, so at ISU.
Yeah,
all right.
At ISU, I was sitting at the annual MLK dinner. And I was sitting next to a guy, and he was eating his dessert before his meal, and I was really confused. So I say, hey, buddy, what are you doing? And this guy, he's like, oh, you know, I'm just eating my dessert. And he reads my name tag, and he says, oh, you're Ashley Shannon. And I said, yeah, that's who I am. What's up? And he was like, have you ever thought about running for student government? Mind you, I never met this guy a day in my life. And he's talking to me about student government and all these minority students that want to be a part of student government, but they need somebody to bring them together, somebody to lead them into the system. I think everybody can attest that student government has mainly been made up in the past years, the white straight male. It only has ex officios to represent the communities that don't get elected, and that's the main point of them. And so they needed somebody to bring especially the black community into those conversations. Obviously, other people got pulled along the way from other communities, but they needed a driving force. And so I was asked to run for student body vice president, and I said, okay, let me meet this guy that you all want me to run with. His name is Bo Gersnich, and Edan Rafalovich served as chief of staff, and then we said, okay, we're going to run together.
You know, it's an interesting observation. I just watched over the weekend David Letterman talk with Tina Fey, and he's got a brand new Netflix special. They sit down for an hour and talk, and she talked about getting on the Saturday Night Live and how she became the head writer. And she said, we had to get more women in there because men were coming up with these jokes and women are going, okay. But women, you know, if there's one woman in the room and she comes up with a funny joke that 10 guys don't think are funny, but like 10 women do. She said, all of a sudden you get more women in there. They can tell the guys why this is funny.
Right.
I mean, was there a similar experience for you in student government at ISU like that?
I mean, definitely. Once we got into student government, you noticed that it was still very much male driven. But this was the first year that a lot of females got elected into the association. So when we were at the table, I brought about the initiative, which has now become a campaign called Hashtag Is Just a Period. And this was the campaign I established to end the stigma behind the female body and to show that menstruation is not something we should speak negatively of. And within our own association, we had to ensure that we were keeping the conversation flowing because, not to be, you know, ironic, flowing, but... there were people even within our own association, males especially, that were uncomfortable talking about the female body in a nonchalant way. And we kind of had to say, hey, wake up. It's the 21st century. Like, what are you doing? The female body is nothing to be afraid of if, in fact, we gave birth to the nation you're living in. So, of course, from there, we established a campaign and then we gave out free pads and tampons to students on campus. I was allocated $2,000 to do so, and we work with the provost office facilities moving forward, and we have plans for the upcoming year to put them in a lot of the buildings for free.
Ashley Shannon, it's great to meet you. Great to
nice
talk to you.
As well.
Final question. You came to ISU 4 years ago. How are you different today than 4 years ago?
Wow. I would say I'm way more confident in myself, and I know my abilities, and I know I can do anything I put my mind to. I think back then, I really didn't love myself for who I was. I hated myself for everything that I wasn't.
Briefly, what does that mean? How?
I always pointed out the negatives, always pointed out the flaws about myself.
Yeah.
But I never wanted to point out my accomplishments. I never thought it was great to acknowledge the good things I was doing because I always saw something bad I was doing or something I could do better. People may think, you know, I'm boasting about myself. No, I just appreciate myself more these days because back then I really didn't. And I saw how that affected my relationships. It affected my academics. And now once you learn to actually appreciate yourself, it brings about a whole new perspective in the world, and not only in your present, but also in your future. And so I think I'm in a better headspace, which is being shown outward as well.
Illinois State University senior journalism major Ashley Shannon speaking with GLT's John Norton. The National Honor Society student in the School of Communication graduates this weekend. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Heil Group, marking Safety Week with a reminder that distracted driving is deadly. Using a cell phone while driving increases your chance of crashing by 400%. Texting makes you 23 times more likely to crash. Heil Group says stay safe. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A recent zombie outbreak in Ohio and Illinois has people concerned, and this is not a Night of the Living Dead situation, but a real and deadly problem that can impact your pet. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of GLT's Animal House.
Reports of raccoons behaving strangely in the Youngstown and Cook County areas last month revealed a problem that can kill both wildlife and domestic pets. The so-called zombie raccoons appeared early this spring, earning their nickname by staggering on their hind legs toward people. The raccoons would bare their teeth, then topple over before rising and staggering forward again. Although their behavior is reminiscent of something from a George Romero film, the truth is more terrifying. Animal experts say the raccoons have distemper. Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal says distemper is actually very closely related to the measles virus in humans.
But humans have no threat from distemper.
So we can't catch it from our
animals? No. There have been some theories in the past that certain things like maybe multiple sclerosis or had relationships with canine distemper, but those have not been proven through, and right now we feel that there's absolutely no risk at all, regardless of immunocompetence, that with this disease. It's mostly known as a disease of domestic dogs. It's one of the top two reasons that we do our standard annual quote-unquote distemper shot in dogs.
Don't cats get distemper too, or is it different?
that's probably like a whole nother episode. It's very confusing. Feline distemper is a similar virus to canine parvovirus. They call
it
feline.
Well, whoever decided to call them both yes. distemper?
I think it was just to mess with vet students. So we can spend about a year or two not knowing what the heck we're doing. This is mostly a disease of dogs, and its much darker stain is its ability to eradicate wildlife of all types. Unfortunately, a lot of wildlife species can get distemper. It's not a problem when raccoons get it because raccoons are so overpopulated anymore anyway. I mean, it's unfortunate, but we're not going to see a conservation issue. But black-footed ferrets, African wild dogs in Africa, obviously, there's some really wonderful creatures out there that can take some fairly sustained losses when distemper gets loose in their populations that are already shrinking and in harm's way already. So that's a side dark patch of distemper. More with the canine element, this is still a disease that we need to worry about. This is still a disease we see out there, and it will show up in pockets, and then it just causes a ruckus, but it's definitely still a threat.
So it's a threat because our dogs can catch it from wildlife that have it or
so
each other?
So it's the classic window of immunological opportunity when these puppies are coming off their colostrum nursing and trying to get to their vaccines, and they're these little, that's a really vulnerable window for parvovirus and for distemper especially, two of the main hitters on puppies. So this is mostly a disease of immunocompromised puppies or mature dogs that haven't had vaccine immunity.
So if one of those so-called zombie raccoons would wander into your yard, your dog hasn't been vaccinated against distemper, and the raccoon loses with having distemper, sort of loses its natural fear of humans and other things. He could catch it from that raccoon.
Yes. And one good thing, one of the few good things about distemper is it's not very stable. So it does require pretty direct contact or recent contact. Now, it's not as direct as, say, an immunodeficiency virus like AIDS or feline AIDS. There is minimal stability in the environment. So it may be that for 15 or 20 minutes, if that virus is sitting someplace sort of safe, an animal could be infected by it. But generally, it's a direct contact virus. So that's good news that it's a little bit wimpy. Problem is, it's a complicated virus once an animal acquires it. It leads with a respiratory phase, a sort of a classic pneumonia.
So that's one of the initial symptoms?
That is the most common initial symptom, is a pretty aggressive pneumonia. And the pneumonia itself can be lethal. We'll see mortality just with the pneumonia phase. Now, these animals that survive the pneumonia phase have about a ballpark a 50%, maybe a little bit less, chance of recovering. Everyone celebrates, and then 2 to 3 weeks later goes into a very violent neurologic phase. And that is the more dangerous. That's a very dangerous phase. That's where we can get one of the classic symptoms of what's called gum-chewing seizures, where it looks like they're just violently chewing gum. And there again, there's supportive therapy for both of these portions of the disease, but there's no treatment. You just have to hope that their immune system wins the battle. It's a classic viral battle where without immunization, their antivirals aren't going to work. There's a lot of voodoo out there. The bottom line is you give these animals all the support you can and you hope their immune systems win the battle. And then finally, you have dogs that survive distemper and skate through their lives, and when they become older animals, they get this sort of weird syndrome called old dog encephalitis, which is some sort of weird distemper hangover that can show up very late in life on a dog that had distemper. Or you can vaccinate your dogs and not worry about any of this complicated mess.
Is it an expensive vaccination or risky in any way?
Not at all. It's the standard annual, and keep in mind, this vaccination, anti-vaccination battle, both sides have some merit, and both sides have also a lot of BS that they shouldn't even bring to the table. So adult dogs almost certainly do not need to receive an annual parvo shot, distemper shot. That combination vaccine that we sort of give as our quote-unquote standard canine vaccine is, we now recommend giving that every 3 years. And that every 3 year time frame was largely based on distemper immunity with vaccine. So when we give a dog this parvo distemper vaccine and we track all these dogs and try to see when does that distemper vaccination protection fail, it's often 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the road, but every once in a while it's as short as 3 or 4. So that's why we moved our vaccination protocols on dogs to every 3 years. That's largely because of the distemper. Honestly, parvovirus, that's a virus that will set up immunity and could be lifelong. Adult dogs may not need parvovirus vaccination, but those vaccines almost without exception come as a combination product. In our history of vaccinating, there's always the potential for some vaccine reaction. They're extremely rare, extremely uncommon, and the vast, vast, vast majority of these reactions are pretty easy fixes with antihistamines or small doses of steroids. The most common things we see, swelling up around the eyes or muzzle, nausea, acting itchy, acting painful, very benign things. There are, every once in a while, it's never been proven, but we certainly can't say it's not proven, we may see larger syndromes.
Well, if we actually see a raccoon who is displaying evidence of having distemper, what do we do? Do we call the authorities?
Yes. I reach out to animal control. That should be animal control's purview to get those animals. The other thing to remember is they're currently running from maybe southern New England all the way down to Florida, and it's settled down over the last few years. The rabies epidemic there's a rabies epidemic in raccoons on the East Coast. It's pretty horrible, and it's spiked our feral cat rabies out east. We don't have raccoon rabies in Illinois. It's skunks and bats here, and there actually hasn't been any skunks reported with rabies for about 4 years, I think. Still a concern if you see a skunk cruising around the day like he doesn't have a care in the world. Skunks can also get distemper. All of those, the mustelid family, ferrets, skunks, raccoons, can all suffer from distemper. But when you see a raccoon that is like the zombie raccoon, or just a lot of them are just wrecked. They just look wrecked. Those animals are suffering. They're miserable. They need to be put to sleep. They need to be taken out of the population. So, yes, calling the authorities is is probably the best thing to do. The other problem with distemper is that there isn't really there's no classic test to diagnose it. We're stuck diagnosing it on a...
On symptoms?
This is a classic clinical diagnosis, clinical signs diagnosis. Your dog, we think it has distemper. And that also kind of stinks because some of these newer kennel coughs, the true flus that are now in the country, the one out of Florida and the more recent one that came in through Chicago, can cause a pretty violent pneumonia also. And those do have a test, but the distemper is a clinical signs test, and then you're kind of left guessing after you get this animal through the pneumonia, if it survives the pneumonia, do you wait for 3 weeks to look for neurologic signs? So that part kind of stinks, but no, again, it's so easy to protect puppies and dogs from this disease. It's an ounce of prevention, the classic ounce of prevention.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. The cost of a distemper vaccine is very affordable. It's generally between $20 and $45. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a pet-related question for one of the Animal House team of experts, send it at WGLT.org. That's also where you can find past episodes of Sound Ideas and Animal House. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from John Norton and Laura Kennedy. Also thanks to former Town of Normal City Manager Mark Peterson. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.